It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
We are very happy to have on Chatter on Books one of the Tony Kornheiser family and Chatter on Books family favorites, Steve Sands, Golf Channel. Steve, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thank you. And are you coming to us from some palatial house in Augusta, getting ready for the Masters?
No, not a palatial house. Thank you very much for having me on, Tori. It's an honor to be on with you. I'm a big fan of yours, as you know. And my older brother, David Sands, is a massive fan of this podcast and this show. So you guys do a fabulous job. I am currently in my hotel room in Augusta, Georgia. Palatial is not how Tony Kornheiser would put the hotel this week.
Okay, you've been there for how long have you been there? How many days?
I flew in on Sunday in San Antonio at the Valencia Texas Open. This is the end of a 7-week run for us, so it's a good stretch. And always happy to be back here. It's always great. Magical times here at Augusta.
It's always magical. This year, is anyone talking about anything other than Tiger Woods may or may not play?
No, that's pretty much it right now. I think he's going to play, Tori. I think that, listen, you know, it's so funny. People have said over the years to all of us who have ever done sports, why do you cover this guy so much? Why do you cover this woman so much? Why are you covering this team so much? You know, in my case, being a DC guy, do I think the Dallas Cowboys deserve all the attention that they receive? Of course not. I can't stand them. Do I think that Duke basketball deserves all the attention it receives? No, No, I can't stand them, and I'm glad they lost on Saturday night. But Tiger Woods deserves the attention. He's the greatest player of his generation. You could argue he's the best player of all time. 82 PGA Tour wins, 15 majors. He's won the Masters 5 times, Tori, and he's coming back off of one of the most horrific car crashes and injuries that we've ever seen in sports. And he hasn't played in almost 18 months or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing. What is it, about 14 months since the accident? The fact that we're even talking about this is astonishing.
Yeah. When I heard, or tell me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard today that he's scheduled a news conference for tomorrow, press conference at some point. And I thought, because I'm just such a process person on this, there's absolutely no way he's scheduling a press event unless he's going to say, I'm going to play. Am I guessing correctly?
I'm with you. I think the announcement is if he doesn't play, Tori. This is your business, not mine. I'm just a sportscaster. But to me, he's in the Masters. This is not a regular event. He's not taking up a spot. He's not, keeping anybody from competing this week. So if he doesn't play, I think there's an announcement. If he does play, then he's just going to go about his business. And that's what he's done up until this point. I just saw him on the golf course a little bit earlier today on Monday. He's going to have that news conference. Now, here at Augusta, Tori, they have all the past champions who compete. Players like Tiger Woods always come into the press building. So it is not news that he is having a press conference. He might make news on Tuesday morning when he has his press conference, but it's not news that he's actually having one. He would always have one.
Okay, good. That's an important detail. Okay, I know Mayor Judd Ashman really wants to talk about this because he's such a huge golf fan. But Judd, just hang on. I'm going to go with David first. David, do you think he's going to play?
I certainly hope so at this point. Did Augusta put that little video out last night, Steve, saying, welcome back, Tiger Woods? I don't think the Masters does that if he's not playing.
I agree.
This is such a process question, but at what point does he have to tell them?
He doesn't.
So he could just show up on when's the first day? Thursday?
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. I think what's going to happen so normally, and I don't mean to cut David off by any means, but normally they put out the tee times on Tuesday morning, sometime mid-morning. And I think what's going to happen is to give him the best opportunity to compete. He's going to play early on Thursday, late on Friday. In golf, the first 36 holes, you have to play early, late, or late, early. If he played late on Thursday and then came back and played early on Friday, then I think that would give him it would be a very, very tough spot for him because he wouldn't have any time to recover. I think he's going to play early on Thursday. He's going to play late on Friday. And if he can walk the golf course and hit the ball the distance that he has not been able to hit it, Tori, because he doesn't have that power anymore on his lower right side, you never know. You can't count him out. It's crazy to even think that.
But it's such a spectacular story, it almost doesn't matter. If he, in my opinion, as the amateur sports fan, if he just gets around 18 holes, it's going to be insane. And I, whatever I had scheduled for Thursday, which is not important, is now gone because I'll be watching this. I think it's spectacular. Okay, David, pretend you're covering the Masters, and you've got to cover the whole thing. So how do you allocate your time? Because there are other golfers, and I want to ask Steve about this. There are other golfers who are there and think they're going to be very competitive and they want to play to win. So how do you allocate your time and your coverage, Tiger versus the rest of them?
I'm going to say this at the outset. I've never covered a golf tournament before, but I have talked to many people who have. You have to choose. You can't be everywhere and see 90 golfers all play 18 holes. So you pick a foursome or a threesome, I should say. You follow them around. I suspect there will be a few people walking the course with Tiger.
Right.
Now, there may be different rules at Augusta. They may not let you walk the course. Steve would know that better than I do. But at most golf tournaments, they let reporters walk the course if they behave and don't get in the way. But it may be different. You may have to just watch it on TV at Augusta. That may be the case. I don't know. I defer to Steve on this.
Yeah, the writers can walk. They don't get special treatment as far as being inside the ropes, those kinds of things, David. But, you know, the great golf writers, just like you have had in your career all through the sports that you've covered, they'll be out there. They'll be grinding. They'll be out there to kind of catch all the ambiance. As you know, even indoor sport, golf's the same way, David. You've got to be there for TV, for radio, for podcasts, for the internet, for the written word. You got to feel it. You got to feel the energy, especially when Tiger's involved. And I think that the energy Thursday morning, if he does end up playing, which I think he will, is just going to be outrageous. It was crazy out there today when he went out for a practice round. Come Thursday, if he's teeing it up, putting the peg in the ground, trying to win a six-screen jacket, come on, man. That'd be as big a sports story as we've seen in a long, long time.
So great. Okay, last question about Tiger and the Masters. So the Masters has all these traditions, and they don't call them – what do they call the people who come to watch? They're not, they got a funny –
Patrons. Patrons. You're not a fan this week. You're a patron.
You're not a fan. You're a patron. And they're not allowed to run, correct?
There's no running. No running.
So I wonder how they're going to control that, because the crowd would be going nuts.
You know what's amazing about this place, and I've been very lucky to cover every golf tournament, but before I did golf, I covered a whole bunch of different sports. And this place has an elegance to it, Tori, that is inexplicable in sports, especially in 2022. You can't have cell phones out there. There's nobody yakking away on Twitter and social media. If you do get caught with those, you're out of there. Nobody does it. Nobody's yelling stupid things like you hear in regular golf tournaments.
Has anybody ever yelled lachiserie at the Masters?
I got about four or five of those today, but they don't usually yell them at Augusta. At Augusta, it's like Wimbledon. You just kind of whisper it. And I just kind of wave and walk away. And it generally feels like my David Aldridge moment every single day of my life. There's an elegance here that's similar to Wimbledon. If you will, like the Kentucky Derby, not being in the infield, but, at the Derby at Churchill Downs. And I don't know how to explain the decorum here. I don't know why it is. I don't know how it happened, but people buy in, man. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And for 4 days and for these 7 days for the whole week, the patrons, not the fans, the patrons, they behave or else they're tossed quickly.
So the Masters has always been on my list of events I want to attend, right? The world. Yeah. It's always been. And for all those reasons, I'm not a big golf fan. For all those reasons. So some years ago, David, you might have been on Tony's show the morning this happened. But I find out from my husband on a Tuesday that he's been invited to go to the Masters.
Nice.
And the worst thing was, it didn't even occur to him to say the people who invited him to go to the Masters to say, can I bring my wife? Didn't even occur to him. This was end of a happy marriage kind of situation. And it wasn't resolved. It's still a very sore spot in our house. But it wasn't resolved. But I was so ticked off that he didn't even try to get me to go along that I bought a horse. And my line for 3 years afterwards was, honey, the Masters is 1 week a year. A horse is forever. So there you go. Okay, Steve Sands, I'm already exceeding my time. We have to pretend the show is about
books. Hey, Tori, can I just tell you one thing? Can I interrupt you real fast?
Of course.
A buddy of mine once told me the quickest way to lose $1 million is to spend 10 grand on a horse. So good luck with that.
Absolutely right. Man. Never buy anything that eats while you're asleep. It just goes and goes and goes.
More good advice.
All right. Steve Sands, give golf fans and non-golf fans alike who are listening to the show, all 50,000 of them, really good golf book or two. If they wanted to, if you're only going to read one or two books about golf, what should they read?
Oh man, there's so many, Sally Jenkins well, I'm sure. I know David well. Her father, Dan Jenkins, has written so many great books over the years. There are a lot of good books about the history of the game. There are a lot of good things like The Legend of Bagger Vance and those kinds of things that came to life on the screen with Will Smith, of all people. Not that we need to go down that route. I don't know. If you're not a golf to the core person, golf books can lose you. I would look up anything that Dan Jenkins wrote. I know that, A Good Walk Spoiled for John Feinstein is a very easy read. If you're not too into the weeds in golf, but you like a sports book, John's written a lot of books. I think A Good Walk Spoiled is a pretty good one for people to kind of jump in into that foray, if you will. You can get really lost in the serious, serious golf weeds if you go with – I would go with either Feinstein's A Good Walk Spoiled. I would go with anything that Dan Jenkins has written. Dan is, one of the great writers of all time.
Anything Dan Jenkins has written and anything Sally writes anytime.
Sally scares me. When I read her columns online, she's just taking a flamethrower at the NCAA, the IOC, the FIFA. It's phenomenal. I always text Raluga and say, man, Mary, can you imagine having a drink with Sally Jenkins when she's not a happy woman and she's writing at the computer? My God, she's a fabulous writer.
It used to be a cliche that you were terrified if 60 Minutes called you. Now it is absolutely true. If you know you are in Sally Jenkins' gun sights, just give up.
She's the best.
Okay. All right, I've got one for you. Did you ever know Pete McDaniel in the golf world?
Oh yeah, I love it. Yeah, of course.
Wrote a great book called it's not necessarily about golf per se, but it's called Uneven Lies.
Oh
it's
yeah, absolutely.
Blacks, being professionals in golf. That's a great one.
That is a fabulous book. That'd be another great book for people to kind of go, because it's not too golfy. It's more, social issues and social change and some of the progress that's been made in a sport that needed a lot of progress in that regard. So that's a great recommendation.
That's a perfect recommendation for this show, David. Not too golfy, because we're not too booky.
Yeah.
All right, Steve Sands, it is great to see you. And literally, we can see you. Other people can't. But it is great to see you. Have fun this week. It's a great week.
Thank you.
Have fun. And when you write a book, please come back.
I'm never writing a book. If I was going to write a book, it'd be titled "Oh, the Stories I Could Have Told," and I would want David to write it, because David, I'm a huge fan as a DC guy. I love your work. I loved your work on television. I love your work in the written word, and I'm a huge fan. I'm looking forward to meeting you one day.
Ditto. Right back at you.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, Tori, you're the best.
Love you, man. Take care.
All right, Steve.
Okay, that is just great. David, why never covered golf? Just too much. Does it take too much time?
You don't volunteer to cover golf. You have to be asked to cover a golf tournament. You don't just walk into George's office and say, "Yeah, I'm going to cover the Buick Open this week." I don't know.
But it's a huge commitment of time, too.
It is. I have been to. I saw Tiger's last pre-knee reconstruction. Major at Pebble. Mm-hmm. No, not at Pebble. I'm sorry, at La Jolla down in San Diego.
Okay, cool.
I was in LA for the finals. I got one of those pass thingies.
Yeah.
And you walk, I just did like five holes walking. You can't believe how it's 40 deep.
Yeah.
It's 40 deep, and the people are insane, and it's just crazy.
And it doesn't matter if you like golf or don't like golf. It's this insane electric environment. Years ago, he was playing out in one of those golf tournaments in Potomac. I don't know which one. And I took the two boys and I took Devin, the Phantom daughter. And long story short, the boys were just like pinballs, just running all over the place. And Devin, who was younger and smarter, said, "Where's Tiger going to be?" And long story short, I don't know what hole it was, but let's say it was the 14th hole.
Mm-hmm.
She was pretty smart. She goes, "Let's just go there and park ourselves."
Right.
So we went and we parked ourselves before anybody else got there, parked ourselves. He, of course, hit some incredible 150 foot up the hill, down the hill, winding putt. And she looks at me and she goes, "Okay, I'm good." And we left. Okay. Mayor Judd Ashman, did you just love that conversation about golf?
I loved it. I mean, I feel like I know just slightly more about golf than I do about quantum physics. And most of that comes from Steve Sands in conversation with father and son Kornheiser. But anyway, I do want to say there's a tie-in because he mentioned John Feinstein's book, A Good Walk Spoiled. Uh-huh. And we are going to talk about the Gaithersburg Book Festival. John Feinstein will be one of the authors appearing there. So your listeners, if they're interested, if they have that book, want to get a copy signed, bring it on.
That is an excellent segue. So we have Judd on because we love Judd. He's our favorite mayor. And because Wonderful Worlds Colliding, Chatter and Books is one of the sponsors of the Gaithersburg Book Festival. Judd, take it away. Remind us. You've talked about it before on the show, but remind us how long you're back in person this year, what we can look forward to. Give us your
feel. So first off, I want to say that we are so honored to have you guys on board as a partner to the Gaithersburg Book Festival. Chatter on Books is one of those podcasts that I listen to regardless of what's going on in the world. And I'm always talking it up to friends and colleagues. And so it means a lot to me. And what the partnership means to your listeners is that you're going to hear between now and May 21st, some more about the Gaithersburg Book Festival. And if you want to come meet Tori and hopefully David and hopefully Claude on May 21st at our book festival, they're going to participate. They're going to be part of a panel with a couple of really terrific mystery writers. And I'm going to get to that, but to get to your question, this I think is the 13th annual Gaithersburg Book Festival. I lost count because of COVID because we went virtual for a couple of years. But what we do is we bring in some of the best authors, journalists, educators on the planet to come speak about their latest work and sign books. We have workshops for aspiring writers and we have activities for kids. But basically any genre that you like, that you're interested in, whether it's history or mystery or fiction, nonfiction, what have you, we have programs that you're going to enjoy at the book festival. And the best part about it is it's entirely free to attend and free to park, which you can say virtually nowhere else in the DC metro area.
Not in those darn golf tournaments. Any of those. Exactly.
Exactly.
Your F1 race, there's going to have to be free parking. Judd, how did you get this going 13 years ago? You're the founder, the creator, the inspiration for the book festival, right? How did you get it going?
Yeah, I mean, I was inspired by the National Book Festival, and I grew up in Miami, so I was also inspired by the Miami Book Fair, which is one of the larger book events in the country. And there was a point where the future of the National Book Festival was in doubt, and I said, well, if they have to cancel, why couldn't we do one of our own in Gaithersburg and put Gaithersburg on the cultural map?
Right.
And so I feel like we've had a lot of success there.
I think it's great that it's back in person this year, but you guys have gotten some huge numbers, correct?
Yes, we've had over 20,000 people at our festival a couple of different times. Some things have to go right. We've got to get good weather because it's an outdoor festival.
Right.
And, you know, COVID hasn't helped us, but we're hoping that this is like coming out of a cocoon after 2 years, and we're just going to sort of float like a butterfly after
this. Nice little butterfly. Who's your this is an unfair question, but over the 13 years, your favorite author so far?
Oh man, that's impossible. That's a Sophie's choice.
Your favorite child. Come on any given day, I could tell you who my favorite child is. So favorite.
I'll tell you what. Here's a story I like. When Madeline Miller, who wrote The Song of Achilles and Circe.
Oh yeah.
When she first came out with Song of Achilles, we recruited her, and I want to say in the lead up to the book festival, that's when she hit it big. And so when she came to the book festival, she was a big deal. She had been, she'd won the Orange Prize over Great Britain, and it was a big bestseller. And I feel like what we do is we recruit these authors when they're on the way up. And so now, she came to speak with us for Circe as well. And now I look at the Washington Post bestseller list for paperbacks every other week, and both of those books are still in it after 8 years.
Yeah.
And I feel like you could have met her and had a, you know, gotten to know Madeline Miller at our festival.
You have Sean Cosby this year, S.A. Cosby, who we've had on Chatter. He is spectacular. Razorblade Tears.
Fantastic book.
Spectacular. He is a force beyond nature. And I think he's going to be great. I bet he is great at book festivals. Kind of following the book festival out in Tucson. And it was one of the first ones that they've had in person since we're not past the pandemic, but people are coming out of the pandemic. And it was hilarious because it was like your favorite high school reunion. Everyone was so excited to be in person, and authors were having their pictures taken with one another and signing each other's books. It was adorable. So
I can't wait. It's like a couple weeks ago, we had our St. Patrick's Day parade in the city of Gaithersburg, and it was such a love fest. It was crazy.
Because people were just happy to be out there.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. In terms of let me just plug a couple of authors and then we'll go on to Daniel
Please
Pink,
do.
Who
Hi, Dan.
I'm delighted to meet. People who've recently been on Chatter on Books, Amy Argott-Singer is going to be at the festival, Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby, Karen Tanabe, Tom Rosensteel, Ed Imar, and Lou Byard are doing are interviewing authors on stage. But like we have some amazing authors. If you're into politics, we got Jamie Raskin and Adam Schiff, both have books. Fiona Hill, so a lot of impeachment stories, fiction. Jocelyn Nicole Johnson, National Book Critics Circle Award finalist. B.A. Shapiro from The Art Forger. Sci-fi, John Scalzi. Children's authors, Peter Reynolds, Timothy Young, Alex Timbers, who actually is like a famous Tony Award-winning Broadway director who's written a children's book who's coming over. So lots of cool people to meet.
Excellent. We are looking forward to it. We appreciate being a part of it. And we really, really look forward to it.
Likewise.
And then not this year because you're already booked, but next year you'll have to have on Dan Pink.
Would love to.
So spectacular in book and in person. Dan Pink, welcome back to Chatter. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks. I just put Razorblade Tears on my wish list.
It is a great book.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of it.
That's a good book.
It is a great book. Black guy, white guy, don't know each other. Sons are partners. They get murdered. And the two who both come to the table with their backgrounds, their histories, their everything, trying to find out who murdered their sons. It is spectacular.
I don't even need that. I had, as soon as you mentioned the title, there were three people on this call who went, ugh. That's enough for me.
Yeah.
I don't.
You had
me at ugh.
Exactly. Look at you. Where are you, Dan Pink? Okay, for people who can't see this, I don't think Rate My Room is going to give you a high score, but it looks very bookish.
I think you're right on both counts. No, I'm in my I'm in Pink Ink World headquarters, which is the garage behind my house.
Nice. Okay, I'll jump to one of my questions I usually ask in 60 seconds more. For those who cannot see this, we have Dan looking very. David, help me with a word. Those glasses are very...
Professorial, senatorial.
Very professorial.
Not senatorial. No,
right,
I think professorial, yeah.
David, don't insult him so early in the show.
I'm sorry.
Calling somebody a senator.
We're getting an old-fashioned after taking some Percocets. I don't know what's going on.
No, he's got some dark glasses on, but his background is shelf after shelf after shelf of books. Dan Pink, how do you organize your books? By author, subject, or color?
There's a little known fourth option, which is not very well, and that's where I fall. Yeah,
there you go. So just throw them up there.
Sort of vaguely by topic, but in a much more half-assed way.
Okay, again, I'm just obsessed with this now. Can you look over what I think is your left shoulder? All the blue books? Are those blue or green? I'm colorblind.
They're teal.
Teal. Thank you.
That's my book, man.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are those the ones that the 50, the 5,000 the publisher sends you and you can't give enough of them away? And so
you know what? It's like if somebody comes into my office, you know, and they pass the test, they get a free book.
Get a free book. Yeah.
If they don't pass the if I don't like them, they get two.
Your eye went right to the book, Tori, which is what smart people do.
Exactly. Okay, Dan Pink, we want to talk often and just so enthusiastically about the power of regret. How looking backward moves us forward. It's fabulous. And
thanks.
I am really going to say, this is absolutely true. Your books, because you've written about communicating, you know, to sell as human. You've written about time, which is when I personally have given away more copies of your book than anybody else's.
Hey, thank you.
We've had fabulous authors on the show. I think when I worked for SAP, which is a German software company, I think we had to find the German translation of the To Sell as Human, but 225 copies of that. So,
in German,
you're welcome.
225 German copies. That is tens of dollars of royalties for the Pink family.
So now we're on to regrets, and I want to read. I love Sanjay Gupta, and he wrote a blurb on the back of your book.
Oh yeah,
and he says every time I read a Dan Pink book, I walk away a better and more informed person, and I agree. So you've talked about selling, you've talked about communicating, you've talked about time. What inspired you to talk about regret?
I had regrets. I was dealing with them myself. And I was at a moment in my life where I was kind of reckoning with them. I don't think that this is a book I would have written in my 30s. I didn't have enough mileage on me. There's no way. But in my 50s, it in some weird way, it felt kind of inevitable. But the impetus was when our elder daughter graduated from college, and I was like sort of freaking out at the college graduation, right. Wondering. I mean, anybody with kids has been there. It's like, what? This kid was just born. Like, how is she graduating? Yes. Like, she was born on Tuesday, and now it's Saturday, and she's graduating. And then, you know, sort of internally, it was like, wait a second, how can I have a kid who's graduating from college? Because I'm 27. This is not mathematically possible. And I started thinking about my own regrets, and I did something. I'm a big believer in socializing ideas. Like, if you have an idea in your head, tell people about it. Talk to people about it. No one's going to steal your idea. And so I said, I started talking to people about regrets, my regrets, and I got this response that a writer always wants, which is that people leaned in. I honestly don't mean that metaphorically. I meant, oh my God, like literally leaning forward, wanting to talk about it, wanting to share your regrets. And so I was actually working on an entirely different book. And
commercial interruption. What were you working on?
I was working on a book that was kind of a sort of a field guide to human beings. The conceit was that if you really want to understand human behavior and the human condition, there are only 10, could have been 7, could have been 12, but only X number of things that you need to know. And so it was sort of like everything you need to know about human behavior you can distill in this essence. And so it would be
okay,
sort of—
Okay, Dan, you're still too young for that book, okay?
The word conceit is
correctly chosen.
The idea was is that if like imagine there were aliens who arrived on planet Earth. And you're like, oh my God, what is this species about? You could hand them this book and say, this is what you need to know.
Okay. I just want to point out to those of you who can't see Dan Pink, as he is conceitedly telling us the story, he's got a number 2 pencil in his hand.
Yes,
I just want to point that out. A number 2 pencil. Okay, Dan.
What do you got against pencils?
God, they make those little scratchy noises. I've never liked pencils. I hate pencils.
I hate pencils.
There are no pencils in my house. I hate them.
Are you serious?
I'm very serious. I think this probably goes back to a really traumatic childhood.
So writing utensil, you use it, you put it away. What's the big deal?
It makes a scratchy noise. Okay. And it involves nuns. It's just...
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry to... Here, I'll put it here. I'll gesture with this in my hand. Is that better?
Thank you very much.
How about a blue Sharpie?
Much better.
Yeah.
I love Sharpies because, man, you are committed.
How about a pair of scissors? I can just go like this.
No. Sharpie is good. Sharpie means commitment.
Okay.
Okay, to set up all of our thinking for this and your own personal experience that created your decision to write about the power of regret, I'm going to go in alphabetical order. David and then you, Judd. Big personal regrets.
The show's not long enough, Tori.
That's exactly. But, you know, share those ones with us knowing that our families will never listen to this show. So,
you know, regret is very personal, Tori.
But that's why you should read Dan's book.
I loved all of my regrets. You're avoiding my question. One regret.
Going to 3 Caps games this season. That's okay. One regret.
No, that's not a regret. No, because I have to explain this because Dan said something very profound in an interview that I listened to the other day that he gave as I was trying to think about how I wanted to talk to him. And it was, he said, if you only regret outcomes, then you're just disappointed. Yeah. And that's me.
Oh,
that's me. That's me. That's what I do.
I
stew in the outcomes of my life. The process was fine. It's just the outcomes I can't get past. And that's what I stumble on all the time. Wow. And I don't know if that's not regret, right?
It's not because regret requires agency. Regret is your fault. What you're describing is in some ways disappointment.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about actually looking hard at our regrets is that it allows us to excavate what's our responsibility and what isn't. I mean, I've done this like one of my favorite exercises is a failure resume where you list all of your failures, screw-ups, mistakes, blunders, and then in the next column you list what you learned from it, and then in the next column you list what you're going to do about it. And when I did this myself, what I found is in that second column is that sometimes there isn't a lesson. It's just like shit happens, things don't work out, and that's life. And yeah. and life is full of that kind of disappointment. And I think one of the lessons I think that regret teaches us is how do we tease out what do we have control over and what do we know?
Yeah, I would say this story. I have among my major regrets is that I chose a profession in which I was an observer rather than a participant my entire life.
Interesting.
I wish I had been more of a participant in life as opposed to observing other people live their lives. But that's what reporters do. We observe other people doing things and saying things, and we write about them.
But tell me, David. So what's your lesson from that? That you felt like you weren't, you should have been in the arena. That you want to be in the arena.
I should have done more. There's more things I could have and probably should have done when I was young. When you have energy and you have the facility and the capacity to kind of multitask on a higher level, I think because your body's not breaking down, you know? There's things that I wish I should have done, you know, like I always thought, you know what? I should have gotten my master's, you know, like I could have. I had a professor tell me, hey, I'll help you. You really are very smart. You should go get your master's. And I was like, yeah, it's a great idea. And then somebody offered me a job and I took it, you know? And so...
But here's the thing. You're like my age. You're like you got plenty of the idea of you're getting a you could totally get. I mean,
of course,
you could get a master's.
But that's just an example.
And of course you could. But here, but let's stick with this for a moment. Yeah. You.
I'm not paying you $180 an hour, by the way. That's
really? Well, I'm way more expensive than that.
Dr. Pink is up to about $250 an hour, David. Yeah. Dr. Pink.
No, but I think, David, this is actually really important. It's why it's so important to talk about our regrets, because it's what they do is they reveal what we value and they instruct us on what to do. And it strikes me that you value probably from being an observer for all these years, and also such a skilled and astute observer of all these years of people in the arena. I mean the arena metaphorically, not necessarily, not Verizon Center, you know. Mm-hmm. Is that you want to be in the arena in some way. And so I think that something that you could consider doing is what does that mean for you in the next phase of your life?
Yes.
And obviously it doesn't have to be, I mean, are you talking about sports or are you talking about more broadly?
No, not especially. I mean, not participating because I sucked at everything I tried. It's okay. And everybody doesn't get every gift. It's okay.
Maybe you want to be in the arena by running for office.
Exactly. That's the kind of thing, or being a press secretary or something like that.
Yeah, yes, do that. But here's the thing. I mean, I would run for mayor of Gaithersburg.
I'd be available. So.
Excellent.
I would get the drink out of your. I mean, as your advisor, and Tori and I would advise you to get the drink out of your hand.
This is how I roll, people. You got to love me or hate me.
Really?
With my old fashioned.
I just use the mug to cover up the beer. Okay, if you're just joining us in Chatter on Books, you've joined the therapy session of David Aldridge with Dr. Dan King, which is spectacular. Okay, Mayor of Gaithersburg, soon to be ex-Mayor of Gaithersburg, because David's going to run. Regrets? Because you have this incredible life, and I know more about what you do outside being mayor and the book festival and everything else. Any regrets that you can share?
Well, I feel like as an elected official, I'm not allowed to acknowledge any regrets. So obviously, everything in this book was entirely new to me.
Right.
I think like anybody that you talk to, you look back on and wish you'd taken school more seriously or wish you'd made some different decisions as a parent or in your professional life. I totally get that. And to David's point, actually, I had a similar regret about graduate school. And so when COVID started, I jumped in and I'm actually almost done with getting a master's degree finally at 51 years old.
Good for you.
I feel like I'm sort of addressing that, but there's lots of things I regret. There's actually, Tori told a story before you jumped on, Daniel, about how her husband was invited to go to the Masters, and he went, and he didn't think to invite her, and I'm sure she made him regret that. Still does.
Big four-footed.
And was that after Augusta finally let in women?
Yes, it was. Just barely.
Which was, when was that? That was like Tuesday, wasn't it? It was fairly recently.
I have a similar story, but it's kind of silly and I look terrible in it. But I want to say 24, 25 years ago when my wife and I were dating and we had just started living together, and we both had a liking for Taco Bell, and the closest Taco Bell was 20 minutes away from us. So I went and schlepped over to Taco Bell to get stuff for Lee and the kids. And I think she wanted like one taco, and I was eating like seven or eight tacos. Okay. And so I come back, and of course I was the only person in the car. I couldn't really inventory what was in the bag until I got home, found out they shorted us by one taco. And I said, without any irony at all to her, they forgot your taco.
Nice. Nice.
I have regretted that for 25 years.
Deservedly so. Okay, I thought about this question. I thought about asking this question. I thought to myself, okay, Tori, how would you answer it? Any regrets? And we're going to come, I promise, Dan, we're going to come back to the power of
regret. It's your show, man. I'm just glad to be here.
But it is stunning. To your point, what you said at the start of the show, you watch David and you watch Judd. And if you could see us on the show, people who are listening, they are leaning in. And I really want to ask you about the leaning in on regrets. But I started to think about this question and said, okay, what do I regret? And I was a complete idiot in school, never worked hard, never. Do I regret that? You know, sure. But if I had worked hard and studied hard and done well in school, then I would have gotten into Chapel Hill, where I was waitlisted 10,000 times, and I would not have gone to NC State and tried to be a pre-vet major. And if I hadn't flunked out of the pre-vet major, then I would have stayed in North Carolina. And if I had stayed in North Carolina, one, I'd be dead because I drank so much. But I wouldn't have come to Washington, D.C. I would not have met my husband. We wouldn't have had our three wonderful children. I wouldn't know and love Claude and Judd and David. So I'm going to throw it back at you, because a big part of your book is saying, you know, no regrets is bullshit. I have no regrets about that.
You do have regrets about that. It sounds like, here's the thing. These things are totally compatible. You can, the fact that you are happy with your life at this moment, the fact that you are happy with the way things turn out, doesn't mean you have no regrets. It means you already said, I wish I had worked harder. Now, my guess, Tori, is that you took that regret of not working hard enough, of being kind of a screw up, and applied that at other points in your life, and actually became more diligent, became more conscientious, became harder working. So here's the thing. These things are not incompatible. You know. I'll give you one tiny regret that I have. It's totally not super significant. So I sort of screwed up in my own graduate school by going to law school, and I was an idiot about doing that. I went to law school having never visited a law school, having never sat in a law school class, having never talked to a lawyer about what she did for a living. I'm an idiot. All right, now. Here's the thing. If I had it to do over again, I would not do that.
Right.
However, I met my wife in law school. So if the devil comes out from...
There you go.
From the mean... If the devil emerges on the mean streets of Cleveland Park here and knocks at my office door and says, I have a bargain for you. You can go back and not go to law school, but you can't meet your wife. I'm not taking that deal. However, I can look back and say, you know what, that was stupid. And in the future, what I have to do is I have to be less certain about what I know. I have to be more inquisitive. I have to be more risk averse. I have to be less risk averse. I have to do the work to find out what situations are like. So I have a regret and I'm happy with my life. Those things are totally compatible.
Okay, good. I feel good. I feel good around compatible. Okay, tell us about the research that was the foundation of this book. Incredible research project. And I'm a research addict. Yeah.
Two pieces of research. One of them is that I did something called the American Regret Project, which was a large public opinion survey of
massive.
Yeah, it was massive because we wanted to draw conclusions about demographic differences. So we had a sample of 4,489 Americans, which allowed us to oversample by right. basically every demographic category, which allowed us to make safe claims about those categories. It turns out there weren't that many demographic differences. And then I also did a what I call the World Regret Survey, which is just a giant collection tool. And we now have, because I looked at it this morning, we now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. It's incredible.
Yeah. A ton.
Somebody may have contributed to that. I don't know.
Okay, there were so I have so many questions, Dan. And you're going to pick. Tell us about the four foundational regrets.
Okay.
Tell us about the age, race, gender breakdowns of okay. those regrets.
What do you guys want? Dealer's choice.
Okay,
connection.
Judge, the four foundational regrets.
Yeah. So the four
demographics. So, okay.
Well, you guys, I can do either one.
Well, I was gonna say you might want to start by saying why it's a good exercise to sort of inventory your regrets and then get into the classifications of them.
Excellent, Judd.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm actually not asking people to. I do think it's a good exercise to talk about your regrets, to use language to make sense of them, to draw lessons from them. But in the survey, I was actually asking a somewhat related question, which is what do people regret? Which was actually a puzzle in the research. The existing research said regrets are all over the place. Some people have career regrets. Some people have education regrets. Some people have finance regrets. In the public opinion poll, I asked people, this wide sample of Americans, for their regrets, and I had them slot them in these categories: career, education, finance, romance, blah, 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 blah. And I found the same thing. The regrets are all over the place. This is where qualitative research, this is why journalists are important. You know, qualitative research is important because I went through in the World Regret Survey and I actually read through the first 15,000 of these regrets. Oh. And what I saw there is something really remarkable because I was listening for the words. It was like I understood what people meant. And it was a laborious process. I'll give you an example. The only thing more laborious than the laborious process is my laborious explanation of the process, which is, but you guys will appreciate this, is that, so I would go through the regrets or read through, and here's an example. I would see something about, I would have a sense of, I wish I had spoken up. Or you hear a yeah. phrase, speak up, spoken up. And I'm like, huh, I think there might be something there. Then when I saw enough of that, I was like, okay, I got to check this out. And I can go into the database and search, and I'm like, holy crap, 109 people mentioned speaking up or spoken up. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's something. And so on this table behind me, I would print out the individual regrets, and I just started like stacking them.
Wow.
You know, and looking at it in this very analog way. So it's like, you know, it's a little bit like... Yeah, so because I found that the tools for the analytic tools on the qualitative stuff aren't quite robust enough because they don't quite understand what people mean. Yeah. You know,
what did it do to you emotionally listening to 15,000 regrets?
You know, it's weird. It actually heartened me.
Wow.
In part, I was slow to this, Tori. I was slow to realizing this, that. And as I say in the book, when people tell you what they regret the most, they're telling you what they value the most, you know?
Right.
And so I would see somebody have a regret about, say, missing a funeral. I'm like, shit, you know what? I have a regret about missing a funeral. And as a consequence of that, I don't miss funerals anymore. And that's mm-hmm. actually really important. And like, I hope that person, you know, does that. I become much better, for instance, about reaching out to friends because I've seen a gazillion things about how, oh, I wanted to reach out to Fred, but I thought he would think it was weird, so I didn't reach out to him. And then
right.
I learned
it's been
that
30
you know,
years, yeah,
yeah,
okay.
And so I found it weirdly kind of heartening because you're dealing with people at a very authentic level. I gave everybody anonymity. You know, so I think that was part of it. All I asked from people was one big regret. I asked their gender identity, I asked where they're from, and I asked their age. And but I think what's interesting here, and going to this leaning in point, and you know, the as a journalistic point, I think it's somewhat interesting too. I asked people. I also said if you're interested in being contacted for a follow-up interview, please leave your email address. But again, the default is anonymity. Mm-hmm. And I expected maybe 5% of people to opt in. 32% opted in.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like, yes, I want to share my regret with a complete stranger, and I want to give him my email address so he can talk to me more about it. But I'm not joking. That tells us something.
Yeah, that does tell you
something. That tells us something, that people want to talk about this. They want to make sense of it. Because there's this notion out there, because of this no regrets fog machine, because we've been sold a bill of goods that we have to be positive all the time, that when people feel that spear of negativity, when they feel like they're the only ones.
Yeah.
And when they realize that they're not the only ones, it's that itself is a relief.
It's absolutely liberating. Okay, break it down. Race, gender, age.
So on race, not very much. The one big difference on race was that African Americans had more education regrets than white Americans, not even by a wide margin. But I think that some of that is actually goes to this dicey issue about how much agency there is in one's regret.
Right.
That is, a lot of times for certain kinds of things, you say, like if you have somebody, like I have a lot of regrets about spending too much and saving too little. And in some of those cases, people just totally blew it. But I think there are other cases where if I investigated more and I found out this person is 35 years old, hasn't been able to save any money, is saying, oh, I regret not saving money. And then I find out that she's the first person in her family to go to college. She has $150,000 of student debt. It's like, okay, that's not on you. But that was the one racial difference. There really wasn't much. On the gender differences, not much, not massive. There is a... women had more family regrets, men had more career regrets, but not by a wide margin. But, you know, not by a wide margin. The one big demographic difference, there's one fairly interesting difference on education. The more formal education somebody had, so the more, you know, the higher, if you had like an advanced, you know, college degree, advanced degree, that the more career regrets you had. So the more educated you were, the more career regrets you had.
What's your thinking behind that? I have thoughts, but what's your thinking behind that?
Well, I'd like to hear yours. I have a theory. I don't know why, but I have a guess.
My guess is that the people who get to the higher levels are probably pretty high up socioeconomically. Their parents or family have probably said, you will go on this track. And it was expected versus what they really wanted to do.
Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting explanation. That could be. I don't know the explanation. All I know is that I have this correlation that if you're the more education you have, the more likely you are to have career regrets. I think part of it could be that it's that if you have more education in this country, you have more opportunities,
more options,
and therefore you have more foregone opportunities.
Right.
Right. Okay. What surprised you the most, Dan? Doing the research, working on this book, The Power of Regret. What surprised you the most?
Surprised me how little variation there was. Like I did this very complicated and expensive, serious piece of public opinion research. I mean, serious. Yeah. It's a serious piece of public opinion research for the very purpose of finding these demographic differences. And when I crunched the numbers, there weren't many. I mean, there really were not. The one big difference I'll get to is age. There was a big difference on age. Younger people tend to have equal numbers of action regrets and inaction regrets. But as we age, we have many more inaction regrets about what we didn't do. That was a very sturdy finding. But beyond that, and then when I went to the qualitative stuff, the World Regret Survey, these giant database of these stories, there was, you know, it kept coming back, not every single case, but these same four regrets over and over again, to the point where if I had blocked out one of the fields, it might be hard for me to tell, like, is this a 49-year-old man in Sheboygan, Wisconsin? Is this a 38-year-old woman in Mumbai, India? You know, is this a 67-year-old woman in Bogota, Colombia?
Yeah, that so struck me reading your book and listening to it. And you did the audio version, which is hats off to you. That's really hard. But the people from all over the world just kept coalescing around the same regret. So human nature is human nature.
I think so, because I think that these, as I said, these four regrets, when people tell you what they regret, they tell you what they value. And I think that human nature, what do we value? We value some stability in our lives. We value the chance to learn and grow. We value doing the right thing. And we value love.
Yeah.
And I don't think that really matters whether you're in Shanghai or whether you're in, you know, Rockville.
Yeah, my dad practiced medicine for 1,000 years. And his favorite line, and this is, he was a workaholic, so take it for what you will. But he said he'd never had a patient on his deathbed who said, God, I wish I had spent more time in the office.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that. I think what that's about is about it's about the opportunity cost of spending time in the office.
Yes.
It's about and the biggest category were these connection regrets. I have to say I'm somewhat skeptical of deathbed regrets.
Well, how much time have you spent at deathbeds?
None.
Yeah.
Well, once.
Okay.
But I mean, there's a book that has it that seems to list sort of chronicle some of these deathbed regrets. I'm just skeptical. I don't want people reckoning with their regrets in their last dying breaths. You know,
right. They should read The Power of Regret.
Yes, they should.
We're going to talk about optimizing regrets, because then they can take care of all of this before
right,
they die.
Right, right. Yeah. But I think what people are saying when they say no one said I didn't spend more time in the office. I think what they're saying is that what gives my life meaning and wholeness are the people who love me yes. and the people who I love. And yes. anything that seriously detracted from that is something I regret.
Yeah, my father was not a particularly empathetic guy, so he couldn't really put it in those terms. Okay, let's get you out with this about the book, The Power of Regret. We started this conversation, you said, you know, I asked you why you wrote this book, and you said, because I had some regrets. And so you started digging into it.
Yeah.
A really wonderful, important part of this book is optimizing, leaning into those regrets and optimizing, pivoting, I would call it, to go forward. So how have you personally optimized your regrets?
Well, for a number of different ways. So first of all, one of the reasons that people have a difficult time processing their existing regrets is that they either block them off or they let them in and they slide toward rumination. That's a mistake. And uh-huh. one way to arrest that march toward rumination is something that I learned about only in doing the research for this book that's been transformative for me, which is this concept called self-compassion, which unfortunately I sort of didn't really take seriously until too late, because I felt the name was so gooey. It can't be anything real. But it is. There's 20 years of research in it. And basically the way to arrest that march toward rumination is to treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. This is an incredibly important skill, and one that I am only beginning to master. When we talk to ourselves, particularly in the face of screw-ups and mistakes, we're brutal. Mm-hmm. We're cruel. We talk to ourselves in ways that we would never talk to anybody else. And so don't do that. Instead, treat yourself with the same generosity you treat somebody else. Recognize that your missteps are part of the human condition. Any regret that I have, any regret that you guys have, you give me 90 seconds, I'll find one in the database that's almost exactly the same.
Right.
Okay? It's part of the human condition. And it's a moment in your life, not the full measure of your life. And once you do that, it's sort of freeing to begin the sense-making process and to extract lessons from it. So that's one thing. The other thing so self-compassion has been really, really useful to me in terms of not dwelling on my regrets, but systematically using them. Another technique, I'll give you two more techniques. The other technique is, how do you draw lessons from your regrets? How do you make decisions more broadly in your life? And to me, one of the single best tools, simplest tool, is to ask yourself at a decision point, if you're stuck, what would you tell your best friend to do? Yeah. What would you tell your best friend to do? When you do that, everybody knows. And so you get a little bit of remove. I use that all the time. Now, in terms of optimizing regrets for the future, I have a pretty good sense, doing this research, what the me of 10 years from now is going to care about. All right. What the me of 10 years from now is going to care about. So I just, you know, I live in the house. I mean, I live 22 steps in that direction. Mm-hmm. And when I was in there right before this, I was talking to my wife about what we're going to have for dinner. All right. And we're discussing what we're going to have for dinner. And it's like, the me of 10 years from now is not going to give a shit about what I had for dinner tonight. All right. The me of 10 years from now is not going to care about whether I wore, I didn't know where I was going to, this is going to be on video. I shouldn't have probably worn a purely white shirt, right? The me of 10 years from now is not going to care about that. But the me of 10 years from now is going to care about, if I'm at a decision point and I can do the right thing and I do the wrong thing and I do the wrong thing, I'm going to be bugged by that. The me of 10 years from now is going to be bugged if I don't reach out to someone I care about. The me of 10 years from now is going to be irritated if I don't step up and do something and don't throw away my shot, you know, given the privilege and that I have right here. And so what you should do is, like, to maximize on those four things: stability, boldness, morality, and love, and chill out about everything else.
Awesome. Okay, have you any regrets that you're not a shrink? because you'd be a spectacular shrink. I don't know about
I talk too much. I talk too much to be a shrink.
No. That's the whole thing with therapy.
No, I talk too much. I interrupt people. No.
That people go to therapy for help, and they really don't want to just sit there for hours and talk themselves. They want someone to tell them.
I think they do.
I think that they need to listen.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, I think David, our seasoned journalist here, will tell you that people do want to talk.
Yeah, people like talking. People like unburdening themselves. They really do. Okay, and it comes back to what Dan said. People want to do the right thing. So when they know something's going on that's not right, they have a powerful desire to tell somebody about it.
Right. But this book gives you a great blueprint of how to deal with it. If you can't talk to Dan all day long. But
maybe that's my new maybe I do like online unlicensed online therapy. What could go wrong?
I'll be your agent. I get 10%. 10%. But I could get this going in a heartbeat.
I should say to Judd, before I forget, I know your brother, Blake.
Tell me how. Oh, did you do a master class with him?
I did. He was a nice guy. He's a huge Miami Heat fan, as you might know.
As am I. I've bugged David with that before, too. Yeah, okay. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, he's a very nice guy. He said, I was talking to him. He said, where are you from? I said, Washington. He said, my brother's mayor of Gaithersburg. And I said... Gaithersburg has a mayor? No. I said, that's cool. No, he's super, super, super nice guy, but a huge, huge Miami Heat fan.
Yep. We both are. That it's like the glue in our relationship.
Whatever it takes. If Jimmy Butler brings you together, Godspeed to you.
Yes, indeed.
Dan, thank you so much. You are fabulous. All of your books are fabulous.
Hey, thank you.
Everyone should go to their favorite independent bookstore and buy The Power of Regret.
Send me the bill.
Fabulous. Yes, send us the bill, Dr. Pink. Couple of housekeeping things. Claude, give us a pitch on Patreon.
Absolutely. The patreon.com/chatteronbooks. You get all kinds of exclusive audio. Like we just did a segment, 60 Seconds More, with the great Daniel Pink. If you're not a Patreon member, you didn't hear that 60 Seconds More, which turned into 3 minutes, but it's fine. But all kinds of stuff like that, the Chatter pre-show, Chatter post-show, and you get to watch us do the show live. Usually, we're going to pick that back up next week. Patreon.com/chatteronbooks.
Thank you, Claude. And we are thrilled to be a sponsor of the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is spectacular. Judd, give us one more pitch.
GaithersburgBookFestival.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, May 21st. Hope to see everybody.
In person. It would be spectacular.
In person.
Next week, we are back with, this goes to something we were talking about earlier, Jenny Zhang. This is one of these people you're going to be hearing a lot more about. She is a poet. She is an essayist. She has a wonderful novel out called The Four Treasures of the Sky. Everyone is talking about it. She's fabulous. We're going to have her with us next week. David, Judd, Claude, thank you so much. Dan Pink, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Listeners, thank you so much. Everybody stay well, and we'll talk to you soon.